It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, with coronavirus testing in short supply, some hospital networks have started making their own tests. We'll talk to a doctor who helped develop a test at Mayo Clinic. First, the Democratic Party announced today that it will postpone the 2020 Democratic National Convention because of concerns about the COVID-19 outbreak. Milwaukee is scheduled to host the event. It was originally going to be the week of July 13th. It's now slated for the week of August 17th. Our next guest joins us to talk about that decision. Joe Salmanese is CEO of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Joe, I'm sure it's a tough decision to make. How did you and your colleagues come to this decision?
Well, over the past couple of weeks, you know, I think like so many people do, you know, planning events like this, we've really been guided by what is in the best interest of the health and the safety of the people of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, as well as the many people that we were, you know, planning to bring to the city. And we'll continue to be guided by what's in the best interest of the public health generally. But, you know, we wanted to do our best to try and, host an event in Milwaukee that we had envisioned a year ago. And so when we started to think about the possibility of moving the date, we reached out to all of the different, you know, venues and hotels and Pfizer Forum and others that we would need in order to be able to pull this off. And we realized that August 17th was a week that would also work, interestingly enough. And so we just made the decision that first and foremost, we would move it a month in the hopes that we are, further away from the center of this thing, which remains to be seen, but at a minimum, it would give us one more month to navigate this complicated public health landscape, and also to bring this event to fruition in the way we had originally planned.
Yeah, mid-August sounds, depending on your mood and who you talk to, optimistic or pessimistic. Are you working on contingency plans if it turns out that we're still in the middle of this thing in mid-August?
Sure. So we'll continue to do that work, and we'll continue to try to answer some of the questions that, we just don't know the answers to today. How many people will come, and what will it look like? Some of that will be driven by public health guidelines. Some of it will be driven by people's individual decisions about whether they want to travel then. But at a minimum, right, we felt like pushing this back a month, it strengthened our hand in terms of bringing about the event that we had originally envisioned, which is, driven by our desire to have maximum impact for our candidate, our ultimate Democratic nominee, but also really to bring the eyes of the world to Milwaukee, to see what we've really come to know and love over the course of the last year.
Now, a major party convention like this, Democratic or Republican, it's known for its cheering crowds of people in one space. Are you thinking about social distancing measures for this convention if and when it happens in a physical way? Are we going to have not those throngs, but socially distant people, sort of in the same space, but arm's length from each other?
I think, again, a lot of that is going to be driven by where we think we're able to be based on public health guidelines then. But, what I would say is that we're also guided by the desire to make sure that this experience is as impactful as it can be, and also, sort of true to the times, right? This may be the direction we're going in for much longer than any of us realize. And so it may be that what we're able to do over the course of those days is kind of lean into the ability to lift up the stories of people in Wisconsin, some of the healthcare and economic challenges that they will inevitably have been struggling with, made worse by the current situation we find ourselves in. We'll bring as many people together as makes sense and as is responsible, but we will absolutely use it as an opportunity to, be respectful and mindful of the times we find ourselves in and also the place that we are really fortunate to find ourselves in.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Salmanese is the CEO of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. He joined us to talk about the decision to push back the DNC from July to August amid the COVID-19 outbreak. The convention is scheduled to take place in Milwaukee this election year. Now, the first of the month came and went yesterday, and that means for many in Wisconsin, rent payments are due. That says unemployment claims in the state and across the U.S. have been breaking records, with millions of workers laid off and businesses forced to close down amid the coronavirus outbreak. So what do you need to know as a renter or a homeowner? What protections do you have if you're struggling to make ends meet during this crisis? Kurt Paulson is a professor of housing, land use, and municipal finance at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of people are in uncertain and maybe unfamiliar territory right now. What kind of protections are there in place for Wisconsin renters, and what kind of assistance might be available for them?
So, as you mentioned, a lot of people went out of work in the last 2 weeks and maybe haven't received their unemployment checks yet. And certainly the individual stimulus checks have not arrived yet. So April 1st was a real difficult time for most renters to make rent. In terms of protections, there's protections at the federal level and at the state level. So I'll talk first at the state level. So as your listeners may know, on March 27th, Governor Evers had Executive Order Number 15. And that basically temporarily suspends any eviction of renters for 60 days through May 26th. So anyone who is currently in a rental unit is protected from eviction for the next 60 days. So that's a protection that they have. In terms of resources, unfortunately there, the story is a little more murky and not necessarily good news. So for individuals who have financial difficulties due to COVID-19, their main sources of additional income to be able to pay for rent and other expenses is going to be the unemployment benefits, and then in a couple of weeks, the stimulus check. A lot of social service agencies, nonprofits, churches, the type of organizations that normally help people in difficult situations, certainly do have some resources to help people make rent and meet their expenses. But as we all know, those are extremely taxed right now. And so we're really in a challenging situation. The rental market in Wisconsin for low-income renters was already very challenging. And there's not any great news in terms of the rental front.
And an important point here, you mentioned that there's this moratorium on evictions. That does not mean a moratorium on rent being due. People are still liable to pay their rent. And I think there's been some confusion about that point.
And that's a very important point to say, is a tenancy agreement or a rental agreement is a legal contract. And so you do still have the obligation to pay your rent. The difficulty is, of course, that for many tenants, they just don't have the money to pay it right now through no fault of their own. So the moratorium on evictions does not waive your payment. That's the same with the mortgage. You still have to pay. So the best advice is for anyone who's suffering financially is to talk to your landlord, talk to your property owner sooner rather than later, and try to work out an arrangement. Make sure they are aware of your situation. You can't just not pay the rent. So that's an important point to say. There's likely going to be legislative action at the federal and state level to provide additional resources to renters, but we don't know if that's going to come through yet. So in the meantime, if you are renting and if you're still in a house, if you can, you still need to pay your rent. And you need to talk to your landlord. A lot of landlords are working out deals with their tenants to pay a portion of the rent or to delay a payment for a while. But even if you are able to delay a payment, you'll still be obligated to pay that back at some point in time in the future.
And you briefly mentioned homeowners. What if we're talking about a mortgage payment instead of a rent payment? What kind of situation are people in there?
Right. So there are some more federal protections than state protections. So again, at the state level, the governor's order prohibits any mortgagee, that would be the bank or the lending company from starting a foreclosure, and there can't be any foreclosure actions or sheriff sales during that 60-day period. Now, for most mortgage holders, people who own their home, there's a very good chance your mortgage is held by or financed by some agency within the federal government, either Fannie Mae or groups like FHA or Freddie Mac. And in those cases, anyone who has a mortgage and has financial difficulties because of the COVID-19 crisis needs to call their lender or their servicer. That's the company that you pay the check to every month. And you can request 180 days of what is called forbearance. You don't have to prove your financial difficulty, but you do have to request a forbearance. And what a forbearance means is that you can avoid making mortgage payments for up to 180 days, and the company that owns your mortgage must give that to you. And they cannot charge you extra fees or extra interest, and they cannot report that to a credit bureau. However, much like the rent, at the end of the 180 days, you still will have to pay what you would have paid for principal and interest. So the most important thing here for homeowners is to call or email your servicer as soon as possible if you expect that you're going to need this. And again, every family is going to have to look at their budget, look at their income, and see if they really need this forbearance. Now, one thing we know is that mortgage companies, there's a long delay in them answering the phone, because as you can imagine, they are swamped right now. So you should not give up. You should contact them as soon as you can. Try to send an email, because that gives you a paper trail of the conversation. But again, just the main point is, if you own a home and have a mortgage, and if you're going to have difficulty because of COVID-19, you are entitled to 180 days of forbearance, but you must ask for it. Your mortgage company will not automatically contact you. You must contact them.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson from UW-Madison's Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture. We're talking about protections and options for renters and homeowners during the coronavirus outbreak. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you unexpectedly out of work, on furlough, limited hours, and having trouble meeting rent or mortgage payments right now? Have you been able to work something out with your landlord or mortgage provider? Do you have questions for our guest about the governor's order to halt evictions for about 2 months, or what's in the federal stimulus package that might be relevant here? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Kurt Paulson, housing expert for UW-Madison. We're talking about what renters and homeowners need to know during the coronavirus outbreak. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has something suddenly changed for you where you're having trouble now paying your rent or your mortgage? Do you feel like you understand what landlords are and aren't allowed to do under the statewide emergency order? If you're a landlord yourself, what kind of questions do you have? What kind of things you've been hearing from your tenants? Are you working with them on payment schedules? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Barry is with us in Spooner. Barry, hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. I was just wanted to follow up on the forbearance with the mortgages. And my question was, is after the 180 days, is it a balloon payment that's due, or you just continue your payment cycle?
Thanks for that call, Barry. Good question. Kurt?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, and just to remind people, a forbearance means that you don't have to pay now, but that principal and interest is still an obligation that you have to pay. So this is also why it's very important to call your mortgage servicer or your lender right away, and they can walk you through what your options are. The law does not specify what happens to that forbeared interest in principal, but there's really three options that homeowners have. One is to make a lump sum payment at the end of 180 days. This would likely be the case if you were able to get back to work. The second option is you can negotiate with your lender a repayment plan. That might mean that you continue to make regular mortgage payments, but you add in a little bit each month to cover the backlog and maybe spread that over 2 or 3 years. The third option is that you would have to do a full loan modification or possibly even a refinance with your lender. Some lenders have already said that if you're in good credit already and you were current on your mortgage, they may just modify your loan to add those additional 3 or 6 months to the end of the loan, so it just extends the term. But there's no rule in the federal law that says a mortgage holder has to do one or the other. So again, it's important that you keep paperwork, keep a good record of what is discussed, and call your lender or servicer right away.
Barry, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Jim with us in Janesville. Jim, hello.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Jim?
Yes. I'm calling. This isn't about a rent or anything like this, but I'm a small business owner in Janesville. And this being April, I have to pay my withholding taxes for the month of March. And I also have to pay my quarterly taxes, which is due. All that's due by the 15th of the month. And my question is, what do I do about that? All of my employees are laid off.
Gotcha, Jim. Thanks for the call. I don't know if this is exactly in your area, Kurt, but do you know what we're doing when it comes to taxes right now?
I know enough of taxes to know that I am not an accountant, so any advice I give you would be inaccurate. There's a lot of changes to the tax law in the federal stimulus bill, the CARES Act. So I would urge Jim to contact his accountant.
All right. Good luck to you, Jim. But speaking of small businesses, we heard from Gary in Iron River who says, hey, what about the landlords? And that's an interesting point because they still have to pay their mortgages, maintenance, things like that, and their income stream may be drying up a little bit.
That's exactly right. I know that everyone is concerned with renters, and we should be, because we don't want anyone to lose their housing during this public health emergency. But most landlords are actually mom-and-pop or small business owners, and as you said, they have bills that they have to pay. For most landlords, the largest bill they have to pay is actually the mortgage itself on their property. So for most landlords, you have about 50% of your expenditures is your own mortgage or debt. Now, some of those landlords may be able to get forbearance on that mortgage if that mortgage is owned by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. But landlords have other expenses, utilities, maintenance, insurance, their staff. They need to pay property taxes and all the other expenses that come with owning a small business. So much like any other small business owner, if your clients can't pay you, then you can't pay your employees or pay your bills. And I know that there's a lot of people who say we should cancel rent or forbear rent. And the only way that would not cause major disruptions to the property owners is if there was a federal or state package of money to pay landlords directly. Now, I think larger landlords should have reserves and may be able to access some of the special lending through the Federal Reserve or their investors. But what I worry about is the mom-and-pop landlords who own the majority of the rental stock in Wisconsin. You know, if I have 10 tenants and one can't pay the rent, that's a 10% loss in my income. If I have 100 tenants and one can't pay the rent, that's only a 1% decline in my income. So unless we also provide a way to help small landlords, you might start seeing foreclosure of small rental properties, which would have a really devastating effect on tenants. I just want to say that the most, the best way we can help landlords during this time period is to make sure that their renters have enough income to pay the rent.
That said, Kurt, in our last minute and a half or so, what policy solution would you like to see state or federal level that you think could be the biggest difference maker to help people stay in their houses until, knock on wood, we're mostly through this thing?
Well, in terms of the home ownership market, I do think that a lot of the provisions that you've already seen in the CARES Act give homeowners a lot of protections, and I don't think that we're going to see a high rate of foreclosures as we did in 2008. But as you point out, there's a lot of money in the CARES Act for various sorts of programs, but there's no direct renter support. So my own kind of back of the envelope calculation would be, if you really want to keep people in their homes and make sure that they're able to keep in their rental homes and that they don't get evicted, you would need a pretty large subsidy or stimulus package that would go specifically to renters, and that would be close to $100 billion. Of course, states and local governments can help out, but they are also in major financial distress right now, and their limited resources are mainly spent on responding to the public health crisis.
We'll leave it there for now. Kurt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kurt Paulson. He's an associate professor of housing, land use, and municipal finance at UW-Madison. He joined us today for a look at what renters and homeowners need to know during the coronavirus outbreak. You can still share your thoughts and stories. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a physician at Mayo Clinic who helped create a test for the coronavirus. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, U.S. Representative Brian Stile joins us to share another perspective on the $2 trillion federal stimulus package. First, one of the core concerns with the coronavirus outbreak has to do with the availability of testing. Yesterday, we talked about new reporting from WisContext that looked at the testing capacity for the novel coronavirus here in Wisconsin. Today, we want to take a closer look at how doctors and lab workers are working to fill the gaps in testing on their own. Dr. Bobby Pritt is the director of the Clinical Parasitology Lab at the Mayo Clinic. She's part of the team that developed Mayo Clinic's coronavirus test. Dr. Pritt, thanks a lot for being with us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, when did Mayo Clinic realize, hey, we're going to have to make our own test for this thing?
Well, it was in about the second week of February that we realized this pandemic was coming to the United States and we had to be prepared. So that's when we put a team together. It was led by my colleague, Dr. Matt Binegar, pulled together about 15 people, and they essentially worked day and night to pull together a very accurate, reliable test in just 3 weeks. And to put this in perspective, usually it takes more like 3 months or more like 6 months to develop and implement a test. They just did an amazing job pulling it together.
I want to talk about what a challenge this is, because this is a novel coronavirus, meaning it's new. We haven't seen this exact one before. How difficult does it make it to come up with a test for something that's brand new, effectively?
Well, there are a lot of challenges. That's a great question. This is something we didn't have access to, so we need to get a hold of specimens that are positive. And early on, that could be quite challenging if all the specimens are in a different country. Thankfully, someone from the World Health Organization and the CDC posted the entire genetic sequence of the virus online. So people were able to access that and design tests that could detect the genetic viral material of the virus that causes COVID-19. But still, as a brand new organism, we have nothing to compare it to. We just have to do our best create a test that we think can reliably detect the virus.
A virus, as I understand it, is a moving target. They evolve, they mutate at different speeds sometimes. How do you make sure you're testing the right bit that's still going to be there?
Yeah, well, you have to think about that for sure. And I think initially that is why we all created tests like the Mayo Clinic test, where it detects two targets, one that's very specific to this novel coronavirus, but one that is broader that detects the whole family of coronaviruses. So if the virus were to mutate, we still have that second part of the test that detects the broader family of coronaviruses, specifically the SARS coronaviruses. So it's a backup to make sure we could still detect the virus even if it mutates. But that's going to be a moving target for sure.
Walk us through what is actually happening in a lab, because I think, like a lot of people, I picture some people in lab coats and there's, you know, beakers and test tubes. And that's as far as I get. What actually happens when you're trying to develop this?
Yeah, well, you first, when you're developing it, you have to get a hold of positive specimens and you look at the genetic code of the virus and you pick a region that is unique to that virus so that you can say that if you detect that region, it's definitely the virus you're looking for. And then you have to do some work on the computer to design a very specific probe, a piece of RNA or DNA that can go and detect the specific part of the virus that you're looking for. And right now we're using a test, the test that we designed and what most people are using, that's called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. It's essentially looking for the viral RNA. And it does that by finding the viral RNA, but by amplifying it and creating it to go from maybe just a few copies up to millions of copies. So it's at a high enough level that it's easily detectable in the specimen. So that involves getting a hold of virus or genetic material that you can then put into specimens and then run with the new test that you've designed to see if you could actually detect the virus like you hoped to. That's all the design stage. Then there's a whole stage where you actually have to perform a long series of experiments to prove that your test is only detecting the virus you're looking for, that it can reliably do so, and that it is able to detect low amounts that would be clinically important for patients.
We're talking to Dr. Bobby Pritt, director of the Clinical Parasitology Lab at the Mayo Clinic, part of the team that developed Mayo Clinic's coronavirus test. Dr. Pritt, so you've done the research, you've got a test that works, you've verified that it works. How do you go from there to something you can deploy in doctors' offices and get these tests turned around?
Well, thankfully, developing tests is something that the Mayo Clinic has done for a very, very long time. Really, since our laboratory has been around, we've been developing tests. So we're very familiar with the process, and we have a good system in place and good partnerships with all of our physicians' offices. So all we need is for the physicians or the allied health staff workers to obtain a clinical specimen, usually a nasal pharyngeal swab or a throat swab, a nasal swab. They put that swab into a tube that has a nice transport media to keep the virus, virus's DNA and or the virus's RNA intact, and then they can send it to the laboratory. And of course, to do this, you need a computer system that can transmit the information and receive it. You need to have a label for each patient's specimen that has the patient's name and another identifier, like their date of birth or their medical clinic number. So all of that is built on a lot of existing systems, which thankfully we had in place already. It's not something that just any lab could just start doing if they had never tested clinical specimens before.
We've been hearing an issue in Wisconsin and around the country that there are shortages of some of the basic science stuff you need to do these kind of tests, things like the chemical reagents, the medium that you keep a virus intact in long enough to successfully test for it. Is that something that you are encountering there?
We are to some extent, but we've developed a system of backups where if one system is short on a certain reagent, we have another system in place. So shortly after we created the Mayo Clinic test, we brought in a second test, a commercial test made by a manufacturer that is performed on a completely different instrument by different staff. So now we have two teams working around the clock 24/7. And then recently we brought in a third test. So having a bit of overlap provides a backup system that if one test all of a sudden became short on reagents, we can't get testing kits from the company, well, we still have the two other tests that we could use. But like you said, there's shortages out there, and it extends all the way to the point where the physician's seeing the patient and collecting the specimen. We're short on masks, on gowns and eye shields that our healthcare workers are wearing. We're short on the swabs that they're using to collect the specimen. And then, like you said, that media, that liquid that they put the swab into, there's shortages of that. So another thing that we've done at Mayo Clinic is we've started to make some of our own things, like the viral transport media that the swab goes into to come to the laboratory is something we can actually make in-house. So we've started doing that. We are packaging it up in tubes and then sending it out to other physician offices so that they have the necessary supplies to collect the specimen to send.
So you've got this test made and done. You've got backups. You're starting to invent or to develop your own materials to use in the place of shortages. What are some of the other things you are working on or researching when it comes to the various stages of the testing process here?
Well, we're continuously looking for ways to make the test better or faster and increase our capacity. I told you already we're now using three completely different tests, one that's lab developed and the other two that are made by commercial manufacturers. We're now looking at the possibility of adding a fourth test because even though we're now somewhere about 7,000 tests a day that we can perform, that's still not enough. And we're primarily testing patients that are symptomatic, but if we ever want to ramp up to be able to test asymptomatic people that have potentially been exposed, we're clearly going to need to increase our capacity. So we're looking for ways to do that. Some of it has been to buy additional pieces of equipment when available. Everyone wants these same pieces of equipment across the United States, so everything's in short supply. But yes, we're looking at different ways to make the process simpler. We're trying to make ways so we can deliver the test faster. And that's another important component. We strongly believe that we are not doing anyone a service if we can't deliver results within a very short period of time. So our goal, which we've stuck to and exceeded, is delivering results within 24 hours. We're actually somewhere closer to the 10 to 15 hours once we get the specimen in our lab.
Dr. Pritt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's Dr. Bobbi Pritt, head of Mayo Clinic's Clinical Parasitology Lab. She was with us today to talk about her work at Mayo Clinic to develop a test for the novel coronavirus. You can read more about that story at wiscontext.org. Coming up, we get a Republican take on the stimulus bill that's intended to shield the economy against the worst effects of the coronavirus pandemic. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, does being bored mean you're boring? We'll talk with two boredom researchers about what to do with unexpected time at home and how we can learn from our boredom. First, the president and some members of Congress are talking about another stage of economic stimulus and emergency recovery spending in the midst of the novel coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, spending from the $2 trillion package passed last week is just starting to swing into motion. Yesterday, we heard from U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat, about that bill last week. Today, Republican Representative Brian Stile joins us. He represents Wisconsin's 1st District, which includes Janesville, Kenosha, and Racine. Representative Stile, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you were quoted as calling the bill far from perfect. You voted in favor of it. What are some of the things that you think it got right?
It definitely got right the fact that we need to make sure that workers who are out of work through no fault of their own due to the coronavirus have the funds to be able to pay their rent, pay their mortgage, and cover their grocery bill. We also got right the fact that we need to make sure we're getting resources to our healthcare system, to our nurses and doctors who are on the front lines protecting us and fighting this virus.
Was there a sense that you were racing against the clock here to get something done, even if it wasn't, as you said, far from perfect?
Yeah, you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And that was really the tipping point on this vote. You needed to make sure that individuals who are in dire straits because they've maybe lost their job or their business got shut down, that they're able to cover their bills. We needed to also obviously make sure that we're driving funding into our healthcare system to make sure that nurses and doctors are able to be there to protect us. And we had to act quickly. This is a fast evolving situation that we're watching play out, not only here locally in Wisconsin, but across our country and across the globe.
Yesterday, Senator Baldwin talked about there being not enough when it comes to support or relief for agriculture in Wisconsin. Is that something you would have liked to have seen more of as well?
This was the third coronavirus bill that was passed by Congress and signed into law by the president. This is probably the third inning of maybe a 9-inning game, as has been said. We're going to need to continue to look at the facts on the ground and analyze on a fact-based way what needs to be done going forward to make sure that people are protected and that we're defeating this virus, something that I would definitely consider going forward. That said, there was funding in this bill at some level for agriculture. Was it sufficient? We'll make analysis of that going forward.
Were there things in the stimulus package that you wish had not been in there when it came to a final vote?
You know, there was a couple pet projects that really upset me. I spoke on the House floor on Friday. I drove from Janesville in my Chevy Traverse out to Washington, D.C. last Friday and spoke on the House floor. In particular, there's a theater in Washington, D.C. called the Kennedy Center. They got a special line item for $25 million. They got put to the front of the line because they were well connected. I think that's appalling. And then after the fact, the Kennedy Center went and laid off their employees even after they got the $25 million. They shouldn't have been able to cut to the front of the line. There was a handful of pet projects that got snuck into the bill that I found frustrating and appalling while people here in Wisconsin are struggling to pay the bills. And where our nurses and doctors on the front lines don't have the protective equipment that they need. So I'm working to rescind that money. But that said, the overall of the bill was positive because it's helping people here back home cope through challenging times. And we're also making sure that we're ramping up our medical care and making sure we're getting the equipment needed to the men and women on the front lines.
There were some concerns, I know, in the Senate before this came to a vote from some Republican senators that, at least in some states, the unemployment compensation part of this might have been too generous. It might have incentivized people who could have gone to work to not go to work. Was that a concern you had coming into this vote?
You know, we're going to see how these regulations come out, but I think it's incredibly important to make sure that we're protecting people who are laid off. Upping the unemployment and making sure that individuals who are out of work through no fault of their own, where the government has come in and told businesses that functionally they have to cease operations. This is very unique times. And we need to make sure that individuals who are falling on hard times through no fault of their own are protected and appropriate for the government, the federal government, to come in and to plus up the unemployment insurance for these individuals.
Talking to Representative Brian Stile, Republican from Wisconsin's 1st District, looking at economic recovery and stimulus spending coming out of Congress and the White House. Representative Stile, before we look to the future for a couple minutes, I just want to get your personal take. You had this, you know, the House was out, tried to get this unanimous consent thing. One representative blocked it. They needed a quorum. What was it like to rush over there and be part of the bare minimum skeleton crew to get quorum here?
Yeah, you know, we can get a lot done via technology on our phones and everything else. And so for the days leading up to Friday's vote, I've been in constant contact with my colleagues. And it slowly became more and more apparent that this one individual was going to force a quorum call, meaning we needed to have, you know, 50% of the members all in the chamber physically at the same time under the House rules. And he was going to force that. And so fair enough. I'm a young, healthy guy. And so I got that news by Thursday afternoon that this was going to happen for sure. And so, you know, I jumped in my car in Janesville, Wisconsin, and loaded up with some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and drove nonstop other than filling up for gas to Washington and walked into the House chamber Friday morning. We couldn't allow this individual to delay the bill more than it had already been delayed. And so we had to get to work right away. And so I did my small part. People are putting themselves far more at risk than when I did. I just had a long drive and a lot of time on my telephone on the way out and on the way back.
Now, as you mentioned, this was phase three. President Trump mentioned, hey, maybe in phase four, let's include a big infrastructure package. He's talking about another couple trillion devoted to infrastructure spending. Do you have thoughts on that idea at this point?
There's going to be a lot of ideas floated around about what is next. I think what is critically important is that we're making an analysis on a fact-driven basis. We need to make a determination as what is actually required to get our economy up and running when we get back up on our feet and we start to tackle this virus. We got to be careful that we don't use this medical situation that we're in, this health crisis, as a backstop for kind of frivolous spending. We saw a little bit of that in the CARES Act, and I've been speaking out against that. I do have concerns that we're going to see certain individuals try to utilize this health crisis as a means of getting their pet projects done. We need to be very thoughtful, and we need to be fact-driven in our spending so that we're, in particular, making sure that individuals who've lost their jobs are protected, and we're getting these individuals back to work as we're getting up on our feet in the future. And we need to make sure we're driving funds to be able to actually tackle the virus, medical research, protective equipment, getting that to the frontline workers, our nurses and our doctors. But we do have to be careful to not have frivolous spending. As you're well aware, we're $23 trillion in debt. We just spent $2 trillion, and we're going to be in a difficult financial situation as a country. We need to be thoughtful with our spending. We can't go out and spend frivolously going forward.
You mentioned that emergency equipment. I know Governor Evers and some other governors around the country are saying, hey, we're not getting a lot of the equipment we're asking for from the federal government. Other states seem to be doing better. Senator Baldwin and I think most of the congressional delegation from Wisconsin was concerned about that. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I was on the phone with officials from FEMA this morning. I joined Senator Baldwin, Senator Johnson, the entire Wisconsin congressional delegation in writing a letter to FEMA and writing a letter to the administration, making sure that Wisconsin is receiving its fair share of the national stockpile. We're obviously, though, in a situation where these protective equipment is limited, and we're also relying to make sure that the private sector is stepping up in maximizing production. I've been working with businesses across Southeast Wisconsin and across our state to make sure that they're getting expedited review so that they have certifications that they can begin production and get some of this equipment in the hands of our nurses and doctors as absolutely quickly as possible.
In our last minute or so, Representative Style, what are you watching for next? What is the next move you're hoping to see?
Well, one is we're going to see how well we do. And what I mean by that is we're going to see what happens to the total number of cases in Wisconsin and across the nation. The better we do by following the directives of our health experts, the sooner we're going to be able to get out of the situation that we're in. What we're kind of doing now is buying time to get more tools in the toolbox to tackle this virus. I don't think anybody's been satisfied with the level of testing that we have here in the state of Wisconsin. We've seen improvements, but we're not to where we need to be. I'm very focused in making sure that we improve our testing capability so that we know the numerator and the denominator of this problem so we can begin to tackle it. We're going to have to continue to drive resources to address this problem, and we need to be fact-driven in our analysis to ultimately prevail over this virus, which we will.
Representative Style, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's U.S. Representative Brian Style, Republican representing Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. That includes Janesville, Kenosha, and Racine. We talked to him today for a Republican perspective on the federal government's $2 trillion coronavirus stimulus package that was passed last week. We heard from Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin yesterday on the show. You can find that on our website, WPR.org. Look for the Central Time Archives and follow breaking news on the coronavirus and all the effects it's having on Wisconsin and the nation. You can do that at WPR.org/news and raise your own questions at the Why Wisconsin page at WPR.org. In just a few minutes, we're going to talk about boredom and what we do with our time at home on the show. And tomorrow morning on the morning show, we'll have maybe an answer. They're going to talk about board games tomorrow morning at 6. Regular listeners may know board games are a subject near and dear to my heart. I'm a nerd about many things, but none more so than board games. My own roster, since I probably won't call into the morning show tomorrow. My wife and I have played a couple games at home a lot lately. Seven Wonders Duel, one about you're developing like an ancient civilization kind of thing. A dice game called Twice as Clever, and it's a sequel to one called That's So Clever. It's kind of like Yahtzee on steroids, kind of. It's got a lot of funkiness with the dice. But I've also gotten into playing some games online with friends and family and organizing live sessions. I just finished one with my folks and my brother in different time zones called Stone Age last night. And we got on a chat, one of those chat sites, so we could actually talk to each other, kind of like sitting around the table. And one called Tsolkin, a funky game with gears and things like that. I played that online with friends. Are you a board game fan? Well, you can email a comment now. We'll pass it along to our friends at the morning show. Tell us your favorite board game. Ideas@WPR.org is the email, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Share your favorite board games for a time of pandemic. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.